First of all, I want to thank the symposium organizers for inviting me, and I must admit it's really tough to follow a guy that's offering you beer and bread, you know, and talking about four revolutions, and I'm only up to two, so I feel like I'm behind the times already. But I would like again to thank the organizers for inviting me. Now we'll see if I can figure this out. Yep. For some of us, I thought if you're going to talk about the Green Revolution that breeders think about, you ought to at least have a picture of Norm Borlaug. And so that's Norm in the middle, and I feel like Jerry Johnson, a buddy of myself, and myself, we're kind of like the gate crashers. But anyway, it's dedicated to the vision of Norm, who, frankly, many of us got into plant breeding because what he was doing at the time we were graduate students and undergraduates is what led us here. So it just seemed that was appropriate. I do want to talk about a few things. And the first one would be what we've learned from the past, and I'll try not to repeat things that Tom has most eloquently stated, but perhaps give you a different perspective. And then talk a little bit about what our challenges and where our opportunities are. Talk a little bit about the plan and, of course, the optimism of plant breeders, because we're always optimistic. I mean, we're always hoping we're going to find the next variety. We're always hoping we're going to meet whatever challenge is ahead of us. And if we fail, at least we fought a good fight. And, of course, I'm going to use wheat as an example, basically because that's mainly what I work with. Now, Tom has eloquently said about nitrogen and fertilizer would increase yields. But for many of us coming from dry climates, the other input that you need is water. And so if you think about it, the Green Revolution was basically based upon alleviating the limitations to production, which would be water and nitrogen or other fertilizers. You could throw pesticides in there too at the same time. And the problem was, as Tom has shown, is there was no cultivar available that if you released those limitations could stand up to it. Okay? So once you started putting the fertilizer and water on, all the wheat lodged. That was true also in rice. You had to stiffen the stems. And that became what we would call a gene in context. And one of the things I think you need to understand is that the semi-dwarfing genes were not unknown. I mean, they were in the gene pools. We had them. And in fact, Norin 10, one of its parents is turkey, the first great plains wheat. Okay? And RHT8, which is what the Europeans used for their semi-dwarfing, was routinely used in the Italian production systems in the 1920s. It's just that they didn't have the agronomy to really capitalize on that. And so it's under those low-input, low-fertility agriculture, the genes were neutral or had no benefit. And in fact, the semi-dwarfings probably were detrimental because you didn't have the straw that you needed. What happened is they became critical as the agronomy changed. And so you see this coevolution of the agronomy and the genetics at the same time. And I think that's one of the things that really, if you look at the old historical Green Revolution, that was huge. And for the next 40 to 50 years, that's what we lived off of. Now, a little bit about the challenges. Everybody talks population growth, but I like the second one, which is when you talk about increasing wealth. Most of you may not understand this, but for each percent increase in income, the utilization of wheat goes up by 0.5%. So if we cap the population today at what it is, and we just all got wealthier, which is what the global goal should be, wheat utilization goes up. Now, why is that? Bread's a convenience food. It may have been our first convenience food. It's not like the coarser grains where you have to boil to eat them. You consume it directly. So wealth becomes a huge thing. And in fact, wheat consumption now goes up 2/3 due to population and 1/3 due to income. Now, we also have to have improved sustainability. And I think that's becoming increasingly important. And that's with our fertilizer, our irrigation, and our pesticides. And then I'm going to talk a little bit more perhaps on concerns we have with our climate, because one of the most interesting papers that I've seen on the Green Revolution and what's caused is by Ping et al., who's a scientist at Erie, where they've looked at the great Green Revolution rice, IR8, which was sort of the bedrock first semi-dwarf rice that was widely grown. And they've grown it for years as their check. They've grown it in flooded paddies, so the water's not limiting. They've grown it with adequate nitrogen, and they've grown it with, you know, good cultural practices, and the yield has gone down in an inbred line, a pure line. And what they're blaming that on is climate change. It gets warmer at night, dark respiration is sapping the yield. So the IR-8 that they released years ago doesn't have the yield potential that the IR-8 has today, or had then. The current IR-8, when grown under the same conditions as it had years ago, doesn't have the yield potential that it did. And that becomes an interesting question because, you know, as a breeder, we're optimistic, but boy, we just don't like keeping having things coming at us to make it harder. So what's genetics and breeding going to bring to the table? So there's a very interesting paper from the Great Plains by my co-author, Bob Graybosch. Nice to have a co-author that's brighter than yourself. And Jim Peterson, who's an excellent breeder for now Lemagrain. And we have a series of regional nurseries from they actually started in 1932-33 up to the present, okay? And Bob looked at the last 50 years, pretty good time frame. The nurseries include a standard Czech cultivar, that's Kharkov. Kharkov is a wheat brought into us, introduction to Landrace from the steppes of Russia. It's been grown in that nursery from 1932 up to today. So you can compare everything to Kharkov and get an average. The other, why is the lines change? Because they're all experimental lines. And we put in a few modern checks, but they change too. And the purpose of the nursery is to provide regional testing for experimental lines created by local breeding organizations. So the University of Nebraska has its material tested in Colorado, Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, and vice versa. And we've had the industry people involved in it also. So it's usually the very best cultivars in the region. Now, I'm going to talk to you about two nurseries, because the nurseries are broken and or divided. I shouldn't say broken. That's inappropriate. The top is the Northern Regional Performance Nursery. Those are the ones in tan. And the Southern Regional Performance Nursery are the ones in blue. And Nebraska, we sit sort of at the fulcrum. We're the tipping point. Some of our lines go south, some of our lines go north. And the reason for that is if you look at Nebraska, and that's an evapotranspiration map, the southeast fits more best with the Southern Great Plains, and the northwest corner, which is where the brown is, fits best with the northern regional lines. And basically, we have about a third of our crop grown in the west, the southwest, and the east. So we fit in both nurseries. Now, as I mentioned, when they grew IR-8 for 40 years, they discovered its yield was decreasing despite having the same inputs and controlling the diseases. So the first thing Bob wanted to do was to check to see what was Kharkov doing. And in the Southern Regional Performance Nursery, basically it's level. There's year-to-year variation, as you would expect. But if you drew a line, it's flat, not significantly different from zero. Now, if you're going to measure progress, you can do that in different ways. And by the way, this is as a percent of Kharkov. So Kharkov's the one standard. The weather changes every year. The conditions you grow it under will change every year. But you can always compare to Kharkov. So this is a percentage improvement over Kharkov. And what you see is a very nice line. It's about 1.3% per year for the last 50 years. Okay? And you'll see some fluctuations off the line. Kharkov was probably diseased when you see in the early 60s where we had such a huge improvement. It's not like breeders did a great job 1 year and then the next year they all went to heck and we went back to our trend. It's probably the denominator shrunk and made the numerator look large. But the interesting point is, if you go back 25 years instead of 50 years, so you go back to 1984, that's a scatter diagram. And Bob can show that if you draw a trend line there, it's not significantly different from zero. And I appreciate Tom having a split trend line in those yields, because so often you draw a line, it looks pretty good, you know, you make it linear, and it fits great over a period of time, but you really want to look for the inflection points. So that's what Bob did. He said he wanted to see what happened in the last 25 years as well. Now, if you go to the Northern Regional Performance Nursery, this is interesting to me because most of my lines are tested there. Kharkov actually is improving in grain yield. Okay, so that's the absolute values of Kharkov over time. And there's a slight progressive trend, which means either the climate or the agronomics are getting better. Okay, so when we make a comparison to Kharkov, we're making a comparison to an improving Kharkov due to management of some form. Again, you see a nice linear trend. You see a lot of lines off the main regression line, a lot of points off the regression line. What's interesting here it is if you go to the last 25 years, there still is a positive trend. So this is significantly different than zero. But the coefficient of determination, look at the variation around that line, which is another issue we have to think about as breeders going forward. So what's the summary? We've had good progress in both nurseries if you want to look at the 50-year time span. You've had zero progress after 1984 if you look in the Southern Regional Performance Nursery, but it has continued in the Northern Regional Performance Nursery, but boy, the differences from the line becomes extremely erratic. And the other thing you have to understand is it doesn't matter. In both nurseries, the yield progress is not sufficient to meet the projected needs. So whichever one you take, however you want to interpret it, we still aren't making enough progress. So, you know, if you want to believe that the data is okay, then you have to wonder, is the interpretation correct? And every breeder will tell you that we always release lines that were better than the lines we had last year, okay? And that's our goal. So how do we say that as a region we're seeing no improvement, and yet in our states we are seeing improvement? Well, there's a couple things you could think at. You know, is it true, okay? Is it maybe we've bred for specific adaptation? That now the Nebraska wheats just do really well in Nebraska, and the Colorado wheats do really well in Colorado, but when you get the Nebraska wheats into Colorado, they don't do so well, and the Colorado wheats in Nebraska, they don't do so well. That kind of thing. That's possibility. Bob's looked at that question, and he's working on that now, and what he said was is that if you take a location such as Lincoln or Manhattan or Fort Collins or Stillwater or, say, Lubbock, that area, and you look at the yield there, he's still seeing the same yield trends. So if you go by sight, it looks like we're still having the same problems. The difficulty with that is we're in a very variable environmental region, and so the yield at Sydney last year was much similar to the yield at Lincoln the previous year because we've had record rainfall. And so maybe you can't look at sites. Maybe you have to do your environments by what they're actually doing and then forget the geography because the moisture is what's driving it in our case. Again, you could cluster by similar, not location, but by the climatic features. Regardless, the breeding progress is still less than what you need. Now, because we sit in the Great Plains, and the Great Plains has a lot of climatic variation, that's one of our most difficult things to breed for, we like to look at changes. This is the Arbor Day hardiness zone map for 2006. If you look at Nebraska, it's mainly dark green, okay? I guess that's part of the green revolution, but no, it should be deep red, but it's actually dark green, okay? And that means, and I apologize, this is an American map, so it's in Fahrenheit, that we rarely get below minus 20. Dark green is, our winters are usually between minus 10 and minus 20 Fahrenheit. What's interesting is if you look at that map and compare it to the map in 1990, so the 1990 is the one that's on the lower left, your left, the 2006 is the map on the lower right, and the change is the big map on top, what you'll see is a large part of Nebraska has actually gotten warmer in the last 16 years. And so that whereas we used to have winters that would be minus 30, in that range, minus 20, minus 30, we don't have those anymore. Or at least don't appear to be. So it looks like short term we're getting warmer. Perhaps that explains the better yield of Kharkov. There's less winter killing. Okay? And the question is, should that be a concern? Because again, I want to put this in a breeder perspective. Well, first of all, it could be really beneficial. I mean, as Tom Friedman said, global warming, that seems, you know, kind of cuddly. And when you're in Nebraska, it seems really okay. Okay? And I mean that facetiously because our summers get hotter too. And so the question is maybe I'll just be growing the wheats my buddies in Oklahoma and Kansas are growing. I'll just move them north. Harvest a couple weeks earlier, plant them a couple weeks later, have a longer summer. Life is good. And then the other question is, do you have enough time? Well, it takes me about 12 years to spin a complete breeding cycle. If the trend is going to take 20 or 30 or 40 years, 12 years, no problem, right? I can spin it quickly enough to capture that, right? So I think we can do that. So that's one perspective. But what's the concern? And this is where you start thinking about how does your genetics match your agronomy match what changes can be. Okay? Currently, Nebraska, and this is why I love working there, is the dividing line. Okay? For photoperiod-sensitive wheats. Now, that's the historical wheats. That's the pre-Green Revolution wheats. Okay? Photoperiod made a big difference. And photoperiod-insensitive wheats, which are the modern Green Revolution wheats, which were done due to the shuttle breeding that Norman Borlaug did, broke the photoperiod sensitivity. Now, lines to our south tend to be photoperiod insensitive. Lines to our north tend to be photoperiod sensitive. Why is that? It's because photoperiod sensitivity enhances winter survival. What it means is they don't break dormancy in the spring. If you get a late freeze, you get a sudden cold snap, that growing point is still beneath the ground and it doesn't freeze out. So when we kill a wheat in Nebraska, it's usually due to a late frost coming in hard. The wheat's vulnerable and it gets killed. Okay? So now, how will photoperiod sensitivity affect a gradually warmer climate? Will we be able to respond to the conditions that we're looking at? And I just want to make sure, did I do this right? Yep. Okay. Oops, that's the wrong one. Okay. We have the biggest breeding programs are to our south and our west. So we spend a lot of time making crosses to the photoperiod insensitive wheats. So all of our populations are in fact due to sensitive and insensitive crosses. And yet virtually every selection I make comes out photoperiod sensitive. Okay? And that again is that tolerance for late frost. What happened to me once is we had 6 years into the program, then we had a normal winter, had a late freeze, and everything in the early in the whole program disappeared. Everything that was photoperiod insensitive was killed. And that's what happens when you're here. Now, if I'm selecting for photoperiod sensitivity and in a warming climate, what can happen? And I want to show this slide because one of my really favorite wheats was NE9625. It was released as Windstar. It held the ground against wind erosion like no wheat I've ever seen. It also had a benefit in that, now this is a slide where you look at on the baseline, the x-axis, the height or the height of the nursery, and on the y-axis, the height of an individual line. So what you see is the tall black line at the very top is a traditional conventional height wheat, very tall everywhere. The dotted line at the bottom is a semi-dwarf, very short everywhere. The worst line is the one that has the dashes, which is in fact tall when you don't need it to be tall and short when you wish it were tall. And Windstar, which is the one in red, was not too tall when you had a lot of height and was almost as tall as your conventional height wheats when you needed height. And what that meant is you could grow it from eastern Nebraska without it lodging. You could grow it in western Nebraska, get a combine header on the variable ground we produce our wheat in and still get all the heads. It also happened to be the most photoperiod sensitive wheat I've ever seen. We had 1 year, the year it was released, which is the way all breeders tend to get caught with, okay? We released this line, it started to be grown, and instead of our normal harvest on July 4th, roughly, our normal flowering on May 20th, we had our flowering on May 6th, we had our harvest on June 10th, except this line was photoperiod sensitive, right? So it doesn't move up, right? It's waiting for the sun to get at the right time. Everything else is flowering on May 6th. It flowered on May 22nd. Everything else finished on June 10th. It finished on June 10th. What do you think happened to the yield of that wheat? And you only get one chance to make a first impression, right? So that wheat's, yeah, it counts as a release, but it didn't do much. So the short answer is that's the kind of thing that worries us. What do you do in a climate that becomes warmer, climate that becomes more variable, when you need certain traits to protect the crop to avoid risk? You know, you don't want your growers to have winter killing as being a periodic assumption. Now, I am an optimist. So the question is, do we have enough variation to create modern cultivars to sustain our future? Yes, I think so. We're going to have to work a lot harder. We're going to have to find the germplasm to do that. And I think the easy targets, and I should be a little careful, Tom, on that because we're going to have to look at that. You know, the nitrogen, irrigation, pesticides already been achieved. We need a much better understanding of how we're going to go after that. and we do have enough time to select them. One of the questions we have is, are we going to have predictable selection environments? My crop's out in the field for 10 months. That's a huge question, and we have to have something to search for. So I'm going to try to finish up quickly, Ken. We're going to use all of the tools that we need. We're going to have to use all of our germplasm, all of our genomics. We're going to have to create new mutations, that things like tillings. We're going to have to use our genomics, or our transgenics. We're going to have to do much better phenotyping, statistics, and bioinformatics. And I'm talking bioinformatics not at a genomics level, but at a breeding level, which only I've seen now companies can do. We're going to have to reassess hybrids. We're going to have to look for traits and cultivars that are either more environmentally stable, which would be less sensitive, would be more flexible. And there are varieties you can see that. That's, you know, Millennium, 1 ton to 7 tons, it's always in the top three. Became our most widely grown variety until we have some new ones coming along. Or we're going to have to modify that environment very sustainably. And more emphasis on accurate phenotyping. I'm going to end up with basically a couple of slides now. No problem? Oh, you sure? Okay. The need for phenotyping. We want it for effective selection in conventional programs, but the real need for effective phenotyping is your molecular markers are measured with great accuracy. The difficulty is, what do you tie it to? If your phenotyping isn't accurate, then your markers aren't, and their correlations aren't going to be accurate. So we need to do that extremely well. And that's where modern breeding is really going to have to go. The concept plus the phenotyping tied to the genomics and whatnot. We're going to need much better automation. We're going to need much better interpretation. If you have a low-yielding spot in a field with GPS, is it due to nitrogen? Is it due to drought? Is it due to whatever? You can know what it is, but you don't know why. And this gets into the concept of adaptive landscapes, where what worries me is I could be working, you know, in evolution as well as plant breeding, always pushes you to select for a peak. If there's two peaks and you're working on one of them, what happens if you have to go to the other peak? It's not too bad if you have continuous variation like this, but I think what you have to understand environmentally, those are averages. Basically, any year, those little mounds are going up and down. You get a dry year, so maybe one of them drops down. You get a wet year, maybe one goes up. You get a cold year, those are always oscillating. So you have to be looking at an average. Not too bad if the peaks are small. It may be that I shouldn't be worried because I have tremendous variation in my population, and if the population spans the peaks, maybe I can easily go from one peak to the other. But I'm still concerned if my population or diversity isn't large enough. I sit on a small peak, I'm afraid to go down into the valley to get to the high peak. That's the part that really worries me. Now, oscillating environments aren't a problem in some cases. If they're small, you can easily go between peaks. So if the peaks don't have a big valley. If they're predictable, it's not a problem. Look at wet season, dry season breeding, right? That's two different predictable environments. You can breed one, breed the other. If they're chaotic, which is one of the things people say may happen with global climate change, that's where the problem is, because you never know which peak you have to be on. The summary is, I think plant breeding will evolve to meet the challenge. We're optimistic as heck. We're going to give it a good fight. We have the correct concepts, we have many of the tools, and we are creating new tools at a rate that I've never seen before to support this effort, but we still have our work cut out for us, and it'll be much more difficult, I think, than what we've ever seen. Thank you. Oh, okay, good.
So again, we want to thank Steve for staying on time. We have 5 minutes for questions from the audience. Yeah. And identify yourself. Who are you?
Hugh Earle, the University of Guelph.
Okay. But the question is the photo period really as important as we suggest it is? Because it just delays maturity, which is a huge problem in many parts, because then you get into the warmth of summer and it heats it up, right? Is that basically the question?
Is that why?
Okay. The best person to talk to is actually one of your colleagues, Brian Fowler at Saskatoon, works at the most winter hardy wheat levels. And he's the one who's shown that photoperiod sensitivity interacts with the winter hardiness genes to allow them to give a higher level of winter hardiness than what is currently found. So if you made isolines of photoperiod sensitive and photoperiod insensitive, grew them in Saskatoon, pretty cold environment, mind you, it's got snow cover, so it's got a nice insulation, the photoperiod insensitive lines are the ones that would tend to winter kill more. So it appears to be what we would call almost like a neural network, a gene network, where photoperiod sensitivity is interacting with the genes for winter hardiness, the other genes, the vernalization genes and everything else, and it gives you an enhancement. Now, did that answer your question?
No, actually it didn't. I'm sorry.
Okay, excuse me. I misheard your question. Okay, the question is if you had a longer growing season, something flowered later and finished later, that would be an advantage. The difficulty in the Great Plains is that wheat has an upper temperature after which it begins to greatly reduce its productivity, and we hit that greater temperature relatively quickly. Our basically growing degree day or grain filling is 28 days in an average year. That had 16 days before the temperature got so hot it killed the plant. So that's what's occurring. Now, did that answer the question?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Tony, my buddy. Well, Tony, you know, I can't speak eloquently. The question is that Kharkov hasn't improved in 50 years in the southern Great Plains and in the trials. And so, of course, I can't speak for the agronomists and the like. I'll leave that for you guys to debate. But no, I think really what it says is two things. Okay. None of these trials are treated with fungicides, so the disease could come in. You put on more fertilizer, which puts it at a disadvantage because, in fact, it's tall and it lodges every year. So I think we're basically growing Kharkov in a way that it's becoming less adapted. Now, at the same time, what's actually amazing to me is that it didn't go down. But I think that's the reason. I don't think that our agronomy, I mean, quite frankly, if you look at our other Czech cultivars, the agronomy does improve. And in the northern region, you can see that it did. But in the southern Great Plains, it's a very unadapted wheat. It's extremely late. Extremely tall, can't handle nitrogen, so it has a lot of problems.
In general, are diseases more of a problem in the southern plains or the higher plains,
the northern plains? I would say in general they are. They can both be a problem, basically because the other problem, everything's relative, the real problem is winter killing in the northern Great Plains. So if you don't have that in the southern Great Plains, diseases have to become
more. One more question.
The question is, would we be better off using a greater average, like a two-year average as opposed to a one-year average when we're looking at it, to try to level out some of the potential due to the Kharkov and just the year-to-year seasonal thing? And that's sort of, pardon me, and especially for explaining the outliers. I guess when you're drawing trend lines, I wasn't worried about the outliers so much, and I don't think Bob is. Most of the lines are not necessarily kept in there for 2 years. That's the other problem. And so if you looked at it, you'd be comparing lines that were started in year one and maybe kept in year two, but the top five lines then could have had included lines that were in year two and year three. And so it's a trade-off. Mind you, in the Southern Regional Performance Nursery, we're looking at 30 environments. There's tremendous amounts of replications. And in the northern, you're looking at 20 environments per year. So I think the replications are probably okay. It's just an artifact of what you have to do.
So let's give our speaker a big hand.